Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this first day of December. It's a Wednesday. While debating the legislation this past month, Senator Tom Harkin, Democrat from Iowa who heads the Health Committee in the Senate, said that it is shocking to think that the last comprehensive overhaul of the food safety system was in 1938. Food safety has too often become a hit-or-miss gamble, he said. That is frightening, and it is unacceptable. Well, yesterday, the biggest U.S. food safety overhaul in more than 70 years won passage in the Senate as lawmakers were trying to help stop foodborne illnesses that cost the nation, to say nothing of what happens in terms of sickness and sometimes death. It costs in money, $152 billion a year. The legislation is significant, and it is going to result in some changes. The FDA is responsible for safeguarding about 80% of all food, but they haven't had enough money. They haven't been able to enforce things very well, and the laws, of course, have been outdated. So in addition to more government authority in recalling tainted food, this bill will also mean more inspections for food processing plants, not only in this country, but it's my understanding that they will be inspecting plants in other countries in the world. We're going to be looking at this landmark legislation, the first hour of the program, and our guest is Sandra Eskin. Sandra is director of the Food Safety Campaign for the Pew Charitable Trusts based in Washington. She spent nearly 20 years as a legal and public policy consultant to many consumer and public interest organizations, providing strategic and policy advice on many consumer protection issues, in particular food and drug safety, labeling, and advertising. She served as a member of the USDA National Advisory Committee on Meat and Poultry Inspection for a number of years and participated in the congressionally mandated steering committee for the development of useful prescription medicine information. She worked for the Consumer Federation of America as well and has written many reports and articles on food safety topics. She has Wisconsin connections. So many of our guests do. Her daughter is a 2007 graduate of the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and I understand that Sandra is a Badger fan. Hello, Sandra. Thank you very much for being with us.
Good morning, Kathleen.
Oh, you sound chipper today. You must be happy.
Yes, I am.
I'll bet you are. Please tell me why it is that we haven't had a major overhaul of this system for 70 years. Why did it take so long?
In part, I think the real need to update the system didn't become evident till we were seeing more and more foodborne illness outbreaks, I'd say starting in the 80s or so. There have been, as many people know by now, based on the recent recall, some continuing problems with eggs and salmonella. We had a major outbreak of E. coli 0157H7 linked to spinach. And, of course, over the last few years, we've seen problems with peanut butter and peanut products. We also have seen a lot of foodborne illness linked to meat and poultry. Again, our federal system separates the regulation of certain food products. Meat and poultry products are regulated by USDA. The rest of the food supply is regulated by the FDA. So I think, one, it is an issue of continuing awareness, recognition of problems that have occurred mostly with bacterial contamination. So I don't think there was a recognition that there was a true need to do something. Certainly over the last number of years, the resources that the FDA has to handle food safety issues have increased, and that's a good thing, but there are some gaping holes in this law that really need to be plugged, mm-hmm. basically, and that's what makes the legislation that was passed by the Senate so exciting.
And if we were seeing more bacterial contamination and more problems, was there something radically different about the way we grew our food, we raised our animals, that made this happen since the 80s?
Well, there are many theories, and I think like most problems, there's not one reason why we were seeing problems. Part of it is just better detection. Our state epidemiologists and other people working on foodborne illness are doing a better job of being able to identify it. An outbreak, by definition, is two or more cases linked to a common food. So that's a factor. Another factor that some people like to focus on is the growing consolidation of our food supply, the fact that for some products, your distribution chain is so much longer, which provides opportunity for contamination along the way. Others point to, for example, let's look at spinach that was implicated in the 2006 outbreak. What happened there, it was bagged spinach. So you're taking spinach plants and leaves from many, many different farms. You're washing them, you're bagging them. And if you have one plant that is contaminated and it is mixed with other plants, other leaves, there can be a lot of cross-contamination. Mm-hmm. So those are two factors that are identified. But it's as always, you know, a multifactorial problem.
Right. Are there certain foods that are at high risk for contamination, and does the bill target those?
The answer is yes. Again, looking only at the FDA side of the food safety issue, as I mentioned, there have been problems with spinach and leafy greens over the last 20 years. There have been problems with other raw commodities, and there have also been problems with processed foods. So both for fruits and vegetables, again, that are intended to be consumed raw, often, if not always, when you cook something, you kill the bacteria. Salad is generally not cooked, so you don't have that, what's called the kill step. So the bill, for example, does direct FDA to develop produce safety standards for fruits and vegetables that have posed problems historically vis-a-vis foodborne illness. So those standards are likely to cover things like making sure that the water used to irrigate isn't contaminated, you know, trying to really focus on the sources. Similarly, there are a number of measures that affect processed foods that would, again, prioritize steps that would address high-risk products, at least initially.
And tell me about the enforcement here. How many more FDA inspectors will be hired? How many more places will be investigated, and how often?
Sure. The bill itself, for the first time, establishes a minimum inspection frequency for FDA to inspect food processing plants. Again, I want to underscore not farms, but just processing facilities. Apparently, according to FDA's own data, an FDA inspector is able to visit a processing plant once every 10 years. The Senate bill that passed yesterday establishes a minimum frequency, initially once in 5 years for high-risk products, and then in a few years that would change to once every 3 years. I think all of us would like to see a more robust inspection frequency, but we have to deal with this sort of in incremental steps. So, yes, it does provide more inspection.
It used to be once every 10 years?
Once
You've got to be kidding me. Oh, my
years.
Gosh.
But again, historically, I guess the view has been, you know, there haven't been a lot of problems.
Right.
And I'm going to contrast that with the way the meat and poultry safety system is operated. That was initially set up in the early part of the 20th century when you had a lot of problems that were chronicled, most specifically in the jungle
yes.
by Upton Sinclair. So there is a continuous inspection for slaughter and a daily inspection for processed on the meat and poultry side. That, again, was a result of problems that you have there. By contrast, you don't have that currently until this law. Don't have that on the FDA side. I want to address a couple other questions
sure.
you asked about how many inspectors and how much money. The law only goes so far. Again, it sets up the inspection schedule. The second part of the process is once the law is actually enacted, then you have to fund it. And that piece of it, the appropriations process, the budgeting processing, is a set process, is a separate legislative process. So we, for one, our coalition of public health and consumer groups are going to continue to push hard to make sure that there's adequate funding to implement this law. That's absolutely essential. So I can't answer specifically the very fair questions of, well, how many inspectors is this going to be and how much money until we play out the appropriations piece of this.
So that's a whole separate thing. That's a House Senate. They have to get together on this. The House
that's
has to approve
issue.
This.
That's a budget issue, exactly, Kathleen.
Okay. And it also includes, tell me if this has been done before, there will be inspections of foreign plants as well.
FDA, in light of concerns that have arisen with products that were imported, has started a relatively modest inspection program in other countries that import food products. And that's good, and I think this will be enhanced. But even more importantly, given the volume, the sheer volume of food products that are imported into this country, the law establishes a verification certification system. Basically, the importer is going to be held responsible to verify that the products that are being shipped were grown or produced with standards that are the same as those in this country. So that is a big step forward as well to better ensure the safety of food imports. We know there is some minimal inspection done at the ports of entry. As I mentioned, FDA has established in certain countries an inspection presence, but really the key piece that's going to help they'll better ensure the safety of imported foods is this certification verification system that's established by the bill.
Tell me about these figures. I hear different figures and read different figures. Bloomberg News yesterday said that an estimated 76 million people, that's a huge number of people, contract foodborne illnesses in this country every year. There are 325,000 hospitalizations and 5,000 deaths, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Are those accurate figures? That's a large number of people.
Those are estimates that were derived by the CDC in 1999. They are estimates, understood, but they do provide some sense of the scope of the problem. I also want to cite to a figure that CDC developed, and they said that looking only at salmonella infections, that for every one that's reported, there are likely another 38 that weren't reported. The tricky thing about foodborne illness is for many of us who are healthy adults, it can result in a little tummy trouble, perhaps some diarrhea, discomfort. Unfortunately, for vulnerable populations, young children, older people, people who have weakened immune systems, they can be very serious, if not deadly. They can also leave a child with lifelong complications, kidney problems, high blood pressure, whatever. So, again, that's an estimate, but that is a widely recognized estimate. It's, as I mentioned, is arguably the tip of the iceberg because so many cases are not reported. In order for it to be picked up by health authorities, you know, the person who gets sick has to go to the doctor, has to have blood tests or stool samples tested, then it has to be reported by the doctor to the health authority. So it's a pretty extended process in order to get it on the radar screen of health authorities.
Mm-hmm.
We've heard, and I think this is true for many health officials, we all talk about, quote-unquote, the stomach flu, getting a stomach bug.
Right.
In reality, many of those are, in fact, of food origin or foodborne illnesses. So it's a significant problem. You quoted a figure that was developed by an economist at The Ohio State University about, the cost, only the health-related costs of foodborne illness are estimated at $152 billion each year. That doesn't include the cost to the food processors, not only those whose products were implicated, but those who sell similar products. We all, it's human nature when we hear there's a problem. We want to make sure we steer clear of it. So often, unaffected companies that are producing safe products also are harmed economically. So not only, obviously, is there a human toll, there's an economic toll that needs to be taken into account.
Yes. I know there were some concerns among small farmers who believed that this bill was a threat to small farms and that it would put them under a a huge liability and having to do all kinds of paperwork, et cetera. They were exempted from some requirements. Can you explain that?
Certainly. Senator John Tester of Montana and many other members of the Senate were concerned that any new requirements would be burdensome for small processors and small farmers. So it's, again, not simply farmers, you know, selling raw agricultural commodities, but also there's many on-farm and off-farm small processors who make jams and breads and other food products for sale directly to consumers, in most cases, but also to other outlets. So what the current bill includes is a provision that exempts these small, let's look at farms for a minute, that produce less than $500,000 a year in sales and are within a certain geographical radius, 275-mile radius, from their anywhere to consumers, but within 275 miles of a grocery store or restaurant that they sell directly to. Farms, they would be exempt from the produce standards. Now, looking at processors, it's not a clear exemption. What it is the modified requirements. They wouldn't have to meet all of the requirements set out in the regulations that, let's say, a larger processor would have to meet. They have an option to do a more modified, streamlined process. Same criteria in terms of dollar value as we see for farms, same criteria in terms of geographic radius when they're selling to what are called qualified end users, which identified as grocery stores and restaurants. Our coalition, which represents consumer groups, public health groups, victims of foodborne illness and their families, do not endorse this amendment. Our concern is that it is a pretty significant or could be a significant loophole in public health protection. That said, on balance, because there are so many other important provisions in the bill, we still support the bill. One thing that the Tester Amendment has done, well, a couple things. They did narrow some of the provisions to make the affected, eligible entities smaller, meaning a smaller number. And there's also a provision that clarifies that FDA could take action to prevent a problem or respond to a problem, even in the face of these exemptions, operating under existing law. So what that means for persons here is that when an entity is exempt, but then there may be a problem with that entity or maybe other products, other entities that sell the product, FDA could step in and basically remove the exemption. And once the exemption is removed, you cannot get it back.
We're talking this hour of the program about what happened yesterday in the Senate, where they passed an overhaul of the nation's food safety system, the biggest changes since 1938. It's amazing that we haven't made changes since 1938, but now it has happened. It was a vote that was passed, a bill that was passed by a vote of 73-25, and it would strengthen the Food and Drug Administration. We're talking about the details of the bill with Sandra Eskin, who's director of the Food Safety Campaign for the Pew Charitable Trusts. Here's our phone number. We go to your phone calls momentarily, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour number two of our program. I hope that many of you had a chance to see the absolutely beautiful National Geographic special on Great Migrations. It will probably be run again. It was run over Thanksgiving and on Sundays previous to Thanksgiving. We're going to be talking with a science journalist for National Geographic who wrote the cover story of the issue on the Great Migrations. And also, if you saw any of the documentary, Professor Orley Chip Taylor, who's director of the Monarch Butterfly Watch and a professor of entomology at the University of Kansas. There are wonderful scenes of flying with the butterflies to see where they go and tracing them for the first time because they were able to find something that was light enough to put on the butterfly to track them. It's an extraordinary story. So we're going to be speaking with both of them about great migrations and how some of those migrations have become difficult because of human activity. All right, let's go to phone calls for Sandra. We start our calls with Dave in Madison. Hi, Dave.
Hi.
Hi.
I was talking with your staff when you were talking about the Small Producer Amendment, so I'm not sure I caught all of it. I followed the bill a little bit, but not didn't follow that piece. I work with small enterprises. The enterprises that I'm working with, and I'm a technical consultant for them, they want to do the right thing. They want to. They get the training. They are establishing their processes, but they may have only. Some of them may only have $1,000 or $2,000 in total income in a given year. So I was disturbed by the initial reports of a flat fee to processors. Could you indicate what the amendment carries in that area and why you're opposed to it?
Certainly, Dave. I want to clarify first. I think you were referring to a fee, a registration fee of $500 per facility up to a certain cap. That fee is not, I want to repeat, is not in the Senate bill. It is in a House bill that was passed in July of 2009. And there were some exemptions from that fee structure, depending on if you sell a certain volume directly to consumers. But I want to clarify that's not in the bill. What I do want to say vis-a-vis the tester amendment is one of the key criteria for being eligible is you have to be under a certain sales volume, and it's 500,000 in annual sales averaged over 3 years. So I think that many of the companies that you consult with would not be subject to the full set of requirements in terms of paperwork and food safety plans. They have an option of doing a much more streamlined process, and they also have the option of certifying that they're covered by certain comparable state laws. So there is a keen awareness of the impact that any of the requirements could have on small processors and small farmers. The reason why my organization, the Pew Charitable Trusts, and other members of our coalition, not all of them, but many of them, objected to the tester amendment is because it grants an exemption based on the size of the particular entity based on its location to its customers. But what's missing there is the element of risk. The whole program, the whole system that's set up in this bill is risk-based. It's science-based. Is that you want to allocate your resources appropriately, going after the products that historically have caused problems, try to prevent them. And by allowing an amendment, an exemption that would not consider risk is inconsistent with that fundamental foundation of the legislation and really isn't protective of public health. I hope that we don't have problems with smaller entities, food safety problems, and if they do happen, that they're addressed quickly and then can be prevented going forward. We are keenly aware of the importance of local and regional food systems in this country, and we do not want to do anything that would unduly burden them. At the same time, those values and those interests and obviously livelihoods of many people have to be balanced against the public health impact. I just want to add one other thing, as I totally agree with you. Small processors want to do the right thing. Small farms want to do the right thing, and many of them are doing it right now. So going forward, all of these measures in the bill, we hope, as well as the other provisions out there, some suppliers, are subject to some private contracts with companies that buy their food. So there are lots of other systems that are out there to better ensure safety. And our hope is those will continue to improve, public health and minimize foodborne illness problems.
Well, thank you.
Thanks,
You're very
Dave.
Welcome.
Thanks very much for the call. We should also talk about what the House passed, what the Senate passed. From what I was reading yesterday, the House is just going to say, okay, we agree with the Senate on this.
Here's what happens in a quote-unquote normal period when there's a lot of time left. You have two bills that are on the same subject but aren't exactly the same.
Mm-hmm.
At the core, they both set up preventive control systems. They both give FDA mandatory recall authority. They both set up an inspection frequency system, a requirement. In that last one, for example, there's a significant difference. The inspection frequency set up in the House bill that was passed in July of 2009, that's H.R. 2749, is more robust than what's in the Senate bill. If we had a lot of time, what happens is a conference in which conferees, representatives of both chambers, sit down and hammer out essentially a new bill that would combine elements of the House bill and the Senate bill. And once that was agreed to, then that new bill, a conference report, I think is what it's called, goes back to each chamber and gets voted on. We're now in a lame duck session. We are likely to have only a few more weeks where legislation can be considered. For this reason, perhaps the quickest path to getting a bill passed is, as you indicated, and as news reports have reported, the House will take up the Senate bill that was passed yesterday, and then they'd approve it, and that would be it. There's discussions going on as we're talking now among the leadership and sort of how to do that. There are some procedural steps that need to be taken, but our view is we're sorry there's not going to be enough time. There's likely not going to be enough time for a conference because there are certain provisions in the House bill that we would prefer. But bottom line is we want a food safety bill to come out of this Congress, and we are very close to getting there.
Our phone number, we have a couple lines open right now, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about the food safety bill passed by the Senate, the first major piece of legislation in this area in 70 years. And we go next to Carl from Houston. Hello, Carl.
Hi.
Hi.
This is a great topic. Once again, you have some of the best shows.
Thank you.
Yeah, I have just a comment and a question relating to my comment, because I heard we're using human waste to fertilize our farms and our food, and this causes foodborne diseases. So until we stop that practice, we're going to continue to kill people, I feel. And also, so here's my question. Wouldn't it be better to fix the problem than put a Band-Aid on it? They're using human waste in a lot of cities now to produce power in digesters and so forth. So I just wanted to get your take on that.
Thank you, Carl. As I said earlier, certainly in the area of fruit and vegetable production, we need to do a better job of identifying the potential sources of contamination. And clearly, animal manure, which is used, I'm not sure about how prevalent the practices of using human waste, especially if it's untreated. That's the key piece. It's safe to use manure if it's been adequately composted or treated. Again, I'm focusing on animal manure. That would eliminate any contamination. But in the produce safety provisions of the new law, FDA would look at better regulating not only water as a source of potential contamination, but also any manure, fertilizer, what are called soil amendments that are used to make sure that contamination is eliminated. So this isn't just a Band-Aid. This is going to really look at the issue of source control, and that's one of the big pieces that make this legislation so important.
We go next to Asher from Madison. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, Sandra.
Sure.
And Kathleen. I'm a food scientist and engineer who's worked in the consumer manufacturing food industry for about 10 years, And I've worked for a couple of different companies. Some have a better emphasis in the on-the-ground response to food safety versus the rhetoric, which is always positive. But my question is on two topics, and wondering how they've been in the discussion over time as this bill has been developed. One is about audits, and the other is about HACCP. So in terms of audits, what I mean is I've found that companies that I've worked for where they mandate all suppliers to undergo rigorous auditing practices to be far more effective in terms of instead of sampling procedures or random inspections where you're only going to catch some things that you see that day. But if there's a top-to-bottom understanding of the requirements of that processor to follow from that point going forward and fixing these things to become to get graded, and that would be on the company's responsibility rather than the government's then. So that's sort of one phase is how are audits factoring into things, and this, especially for imports. And the second would be for HACCP, for hazard analysis and critical control points, where that's where processors are making determinations of these are the steps in our process that require the most attention to ensure product safety. And from my understanding, that is mostly, if not solely, the responsibility of the manufacturing plants and the companies to self-validate those HACCP plans. And I don't know of maybe, you know, non-partial microbiologists that could give approval or to decline or recommend modifications for manufacturing plans that maybe are inadequate to uncover all of the potential risks.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah, you're a great caller.
That's a very thorough comment.
Yes.
Question. Thank you, Asher. On the question of audits, nothing in the bill would preclude a company, in some cases, you know, a company that's buying food ingredients from a processor, from requiring certain safety standards and then to audit against them. I mean, that's an important check in the current system, and we don't, this is not intended. The government inspection is not intended to supplant audits. They're another safety measure. However, we've seen in recent years, and I'll point to the Peanut Corporation of America, and I'll point to the recent egg outbreak, where private auditors have given companies sterling superior ratings when, in fact, there's been many, many problems in terms of contamination. There were, you know, rats or mice or whatever. So the key piece here is you need to have a comprehensive system. It can't totally rely on inspection. As we discussed earlier, government inspectors are not going to be able to be at the plant every day. So it's a combined system that would, again, develop requirements on the manufacturers. The government inspectors are there to oversee that. And then you've got lots of other measures that maybe by contract are aimed at improving or guaranteeing better ensuring safety. So the audit piece, again, is still part of the system. You mentioned it in an importer context. It's absolutely critical there because even if we have some FDA employees in certain countries, there's no way they're going to be able to get to even a significant number of facilities. So the system I mentioned, the import verification system, relies on third-party sort of audits and accreditation. On your question of HACCP, the term, again, is not used specifically in the bill, but when I mentioned this idea of food safety plans and preventive controls, that's what we're talking about. There is no requirement. You're correct. I believe you said that they don't need to have these plans pre-approved. They don't need to be submitted. But there is a system that would be in place that by inspection and other methods, the government can ensure that a company is not only setting up a sound food safety plan, but it's monitoring it sufficiently. So, again, we have inspection as a component of an overall comprehensive system. HACCP does place more responsibility on the people. Again, HACCP preventive controls on the people who are producing the food. They do a lot of self-verification, modification, but there are a number of other pieces that provide a level of assurance that we just don't have right now.
Mm. Thank you, Asher, for your very informed and thorough question. Before we go back to phone calls, what about recalls? Doesn't this give the FDA, did they not have the ability to do recalls before this?
They did not, because as we've mentioned, you know, this is a pretty old law. And only in recent years have consumer protection statutes, ones that cover cars and now toys, they mandate a recall. They're much more modern and recently enacted laws. So under this bill, FDA would give a company an opportunity to voluntarily recall. But if that's not done, then FDA can step in and mandate it. And there's a lot of procedural protections, et cetera. And, you know, many people argue, well, no one has ever, ever, no company has ever refused to do a recall, but there are instances in which at least a few have, number one. And number two, many have dragged their feet. And until the actual recall happens, while there's negotiations, people are eating the contaminated food, getting sick, and right. In very unfortunate circumstances, die. I've heard that with a number of foodborne illness victims' families that, you know, it wasn't recalled till a week after my mother, my child, whatever, I fed this to them. So it's an important enforcement tool, and it is really the last line of defense. What it means is a product that's is contaminated or reasonably possibly would be contaminated is already out in the marketplace. We failed to pick it up during the processing. So it is really important that a recall provision is there that is going to protect consumers better than the current system, and that's the hope.
Sandra Esken, our guest this hour, director of the Food Safety Campaign for the Pew Charitable Trusts in Washington, and we are talking about the bill that passed the Senate yesterday, an overhaul of the food safety regulations, the most thorough bill of its kind since 1938. And we're welcoming phone calls for details. The House has passed a different bill, but as Sandra said, given the amount of time here in this lame duck session of Congress, the House is likely to latch on to the Senate bill. Here's our number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, we're going to be talking about the Great Migrations. It has been the National Geographic beautiful special over several Sundays, and it was also run over Thanksgiving. We'll have two guests with us, a science journalist from National Geographic who wrote the cover story of this month's issue, and we'll also speak with the director of the Monarch Watch and a professor of entomology at the University of Kansas. They have discovered some remarkable things about monarch butterflies because they've been able to trace them recently. So that's coming up, hour number two. Our phone number for Sandra, 800-486-8655. Paul is next from Wausau. Hi, Paul.
Hello.
Hi.
Yeah. I'm certainly in favor of changing regulations to our legislation to make the food safety, the food system much safer, because that needs to be done, clearly. But I'm really concerned about this bill from what I've been able to read about it, and I haven't been able to read the whole thing, and it's hard to get through all the legalese of it and understand it, but it just seems my concern is that it gives way too much control to government agencies to create the regulations, where I'd rather it seems to be given kind of this I guess from how I read it, it seems to be giving both the FDA and the Department of Homeland Security they're going to be able to write a whole bunch of regulations we're not even going to be able to see yet. And then once they're done, they're done. But I'd rather know what's going to be there and have Congress writing that legislation. I mean, they're creating the legislation, but it seems like that there's a lot of room there for the FDA to create a fair amount of regulation there after this is done. And then if you could speak about why is the Department of Homeland Security so involved with this? They've never had any authority over food, but why are they involved with this? The last thing would be Some of the concerns I've read, and certainly a lot of things on blogs and whatnot out there about this, but just a far-reaching impact of this from people, you know, the FDA is going to have control, and the Department of Homeland Security will have control over everything, even food we grow in our own gardens and give out to neighbors, and food we take to the farm market, and you know, anything like that. They'll be able to have some far-reaching powers over that, and then also take away state control over state inspected programs, and once that's done, the state won't be able to get control back. And that's a concern to me. We do processing with a state inspected processor. Wisconsin's never had a recall for E. coli from a state inspected facility. They have had recalls from USDA inspected facilities, not from state inspected facilities. I do not want. I'd much rather stay with Wisconsin Inspection. They seem to be doing a much better job.
All right, thank you, Paul.
Okay, Paul, I might answer your questions backwards, but make sure I answer all of them. Number one, I want to clarify, when you talk about state-inspected facilities, you're talking about meat and poultry because it's USDA. Totally different system, totally different approach, so I want to make that clear. Second, there has been a lot of misinformation that's been circulated about this bill, what it does and doesn't do. If you could point me to a provision in the law or give me some sense of what you heard vis-a-vis the Department of Homeland Security. I mean, they're involved in imports and ports, but they don't have powers granted to them under this law. This amends the Food and Drug Act, and it's the FDA that's responsible for that. Some of the misinformation is you have to have – the only thing that FDA can regulate is food in commerce, so it has to be sold. This law has nothing – has no impact on your home gardens that you grow stuff, you feed your family, you give it to your neighbors. That's not in commerce. And second, FDA only regulates interstate commerce. So when we're dealing with FDA-regulated foods, anything but meat and poultry, and it's only sold and produced within the state, it's not governed by these laws. And finally, if it's a small business, as we've mentioned in previous calls, there are exemptions if you do, you know, not a lot of sales from some of the requirements in the law. And I think I've covered everything except the issue of too much power and regulations are going to be implemented that we won't have a chance to comment on. And that's not true. The law, like many, many other laws, sets the general parameters and gives the agency that implements it or the department that implements it specific directions on what it needs to do. This bill does that. This bill makes very clear from Congress to the FDA, you need to, for example, consider the impact on small businesses for many, many components of this law. Consider the impact on wildlife when you're looking at produce safety standards. The bottom line is these regulations will be implemented using a notice and comment rulemaking proceeding, what most federal rules require. So FDA, in some cases, is under a time frame, a limit, has to propose the rules. You and I and anyone else who's interested in this can comment on them. You can pull up the information in a Federal Register, which is widely available. You can submit comments in paper, online, whatever. So that is a fundamental component of our government, that it just isn't just Congress passing laws. In many instances, it's agencies implementing those laws through regulations that are publicly discussed and decided on and then are implemented, once they're finalized. So I think people can have clear differences of opinion on how regulation should be done, what role government should have, all important, all issues that come up in this context and many other contexts. But it's hard to have a reasonable debate when there's a lot of misinformation. Unfortunately, it's being spread about what the bill does and doesn't do. So, hopefully, if the bill passes, there'll be continued outreach so people know that they can be part of the process to make sure that the government gets it right.
Thanks, Paul, for the call. As a consumer, I think I probably speak for others that when there are recalls, you get a little queasy, and it lasts maybe a year or so, or maybe beyond. When there's been a massive recall of or problems, E. coli contamination, be it eggs or peanut butter or spinach or lettuce, we've been through many of them in the last few years. Senator Harkin said this, that this legislation means that parents who tell their kids to eat their spinach can be assured that it won't make them sick. What about that assurance? Does this bill assure us that eating spinach and those that are at risk for bacterial contamination, that this bill will take care of that and we won't get sick?
The bill doesn't guarantee it. Okay, it clearly will set up a system that could do a better job at preventing many, many outbreaks and many illnesses. Let's look at spinach, for example, a very healthful product that all of us are encouraged to eat. It's loaded with iron and lots of nutrients. It grows in the ground, right? It's open to the elements. There are many potential sources of contamination. It is not realistic to think one can totally eliminate contaminants. What is doable is we can do a better job of trying to minimize the number of people who get sick. And we do that, as I mentioned, let's just again back to spinach, setting up regulations with FDA's directed to do for high-risk products, with which spinach and leafy greens are, set up standards to limit contaminants, set up standards that may require testing or other ways to ensure that the product is not contaminated. You know, if it's sold directly to consumers in its raw form, or if it's bagged and sent out, you know, to supermarkets, washed, whatever, those may have different requirements as well. So no one can guarantee it, but at every step, starting with the source, through production, through processing, through packing, through holding, for shipping, and even in our own kitchens, we all have a responsibility to try to minimize problems. More can be done than what we're doing now. And what this bill, S-510, represents is an approach that puts responsibility clearly on companies that produce and process foods to do some specific things to try and minimize problems. They can't eliminate them. They can just do more to minimize them.
Okay. Diane is our next caller. Hi, Diane.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks. I just wanted to comment that I think that this bill absolutely tramples our food freedom. Most of the contaminants are indeed coming from large, large farms. And the answer is to go and know who you're buying your food from, to go to local markets. And this, though the Kester addition, from what I understand, the streamlining is minimal. It will indeed place a huge burden on the small farmers and the neighbor that I want to buy my food from. And buying locally is the answer to the problem, buying locally from small farms. And this bill absolutely steps on my freedom to do that.
Sandra?
I thank you for your question, Diane. The bottom line, as I mentioned to you, truly local, intrastate, your neighbor, the person around the corner, the person within, you know, a few miles, that food is not covered by this law. If it is interstate, if you cross a state line, if you are selling directly to consumers a majority of your product, the food is not covered by this law. If you're selling under the Kester Amendment to what are called qualified end users, restaurants, grocery stores within 275 miles, again, you're not covered by, yes, you're right, it's not an exemption for processors, but to be honest, those regulations that people are alleging are going to cause such an unreasonable burden, financial and otherwise, haven't been written yet. And there's clear direction to FDA to make sure they consider the impact and do scale-appropriate requirements. So I would encourage you, Diane, and anyone else who's concerned about the impact of this bill on their ability to buy local and regionally produced foods, to comment, to make your position known, to tell FDA, please make sure that you don't unnecessarily burden producers here. As I said at the outset, the Pew Charitable Trusts groups in our coalition have been working on sustainable issues, have been working on local and regional food systems, support those. But there is a balance that needs to be struck between those interests and public health.
Sandra, thank you so much for being with us to explain this. It was really an interesting and informative hour.
Well, thanks. Thank you for having me, Kathleen.
You're absolutely welcome. Sandra Eskin is director of the Food Safety Campaign for the Pew Charitable Trusts. We thank her for her time and for a great explanation of the Senate bill that was passed yesterday, the overhaul of the food safety regulations. Thanks to our producers, Chrissy Peace and Rhonda Fanning, for getting this show together and getting it to you on the air. And thanks for all of your interesting calls, informative calls. We have news coming up from National Public Radio and then another very interesting hour about great migration. So please stay with us. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network.